From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Sounds from the streets of Seoul today after South Korea's constitutional court removed President Park Geun-hye from office in a unanimous ruling. She had already been impeached in a corruption scandal that has plunged the country into political turmoil. Today was the final ruling in her case. Park was South Korea's first female president. Now she's the country's first president to be removed from office. And her removal raises questions about relations between South and North Korea and relations with the United States. Joining us from Seoul is the BBC's Steve Evans. And Steve, how are people reacting?
Well, in the evening here in Seoul, there's been a kind of a victory rally by the anti-Park protesters, the people who've been out protesting for 3 months now every Saturday. And there's been a lot of music and an awful lot of speechifying. Immediately after the decision by the court, pro-Park protesters try to turn over a police bus. And it really illustrates the way the country's split. Probably a majority in favor of getting rid of her, which is what the court did, but certainly strong feeling from the other side as well.
And remind us how this all started, how we got to this point, which includes both President Park or former President Park and the woman who was her close friend.
Choi Soon-sil has been President Park's friend for 40 years. A kind of a mentor. Friend doesn't do the relationship justice, really. And people got curious about the nature of this relationship. Was President Park leaning too much on this friend? Was she confiding in her friend? The friendship, as I say, goes back 40 years. It goes back to their parents, really, because their parents were close. And Miss Che's father was a kind of a mystical figure, a kind of a cult leader. He created a cult largely around himself, that people would say. And that relationship between Ms. Che and President Park continued. And people got curious and started looking at what was going on. And the closer you looked, the more questions there were to be answered. And then it transpired that Ms. Che had two foundations which were taking money from household names, Samsung, for example, $38 million from Samsung. So the question then became, what did Samsung get for the money? And what the allegation is that what Samsung was getting for the money to the friend was the president's help in getting through a merger that Samsung felt it badly needed, or the family that rules Samsung felt it badly needed. And other things emerge. For example, Samsung bought a horse for the daughter of the best friend of the president. Not just any old horse, not some sort of kiddie's pony or anything, but a $1 million horse. And so again, what was Samsung getting for it? And we now have a situation where eight of the biggest companies in the land, some big household names around the world, Hyundai, for example, Samsung, are revealed to have given money to this friend of the president. And it prompts the question, what do they get back?
So what are the consequences of this? And let's start with what's going to happen now between South Korea and North Korea.
One of the consequences is that there will be an election within the next 2 months. And, you know, you can never predict, as you know, in America, you can never predict an election winner. But the polls currently indicate that there will be a move towards the left. Now, the left of center parties tend to be more cooperative with North Korea. Doesn't mean they like Kim Jong-un very much, but they take the view that North Koreans and South Koreans are the same kith and kin, and the ultimate aim is a unified Korea, and the way to do that is by dealing with the regime in Pyongyang. For example, until about 18 months ago, there was a town just inside North Korea which was full of factories for South Korean companies. South Korean managers would go across the border every day, run the factories with North Korean workers. That was closed in one of the frequent spats between the two over a nuclear test. That may well be reopened. So we would expect a government which is not as antagonistic towards North Korea, and similarly a government which is more antagonistic towards the U.S. There's a U.S. anti-missile system just being deployed in South Korea. the left of centre parties don't like it at all. And so there would be the question, would they insist on its removal or not?
Well, we will continue to follow developments in this story. The BBC's Steve Evans joining us from Seoul, South Korea. Steve, thanks.
You're very welcome.
Well, in our recent reporting on the unbelievable number of opioid overdoses nationwide, we heard how emergency workers are saving lives with the drug naloxone, or by the brand name Narcan, which, if injected in time, can reverse an overdose. That, of course, is the good news. Lives are being saved. But often, EMTs are reviving the same addicts several times a day. Resources are being drained, questions being raised. And now officials in Washington Courthouse, Ohio, population 14,000, have decided to, yes, revive overdose victims, but then charge them with a misdemeanor. City Attorney Mark Pitstick joins us from his office. Hi, Mark.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. And tell us more. We know this began in February. What is the charge? And what is the result of the charge?
The charge is inducing panic, which is a misdemeanor of the first degree. And by charging the person who overdoses with this charge, it allows us to keep track of the individual. Some of the drug addicts that we have come through here have three, four, five, six times that they overdose. And so we want to get them into a program so we can help them.
Okay, so this charge is punishable, we understand, by up to 180 days in jail and a $1,000 fine.
Right.
And your goal is to track them. So the question then is, well, why further burden an addict presumably doesn't have a lot of money spending it on drugs or send them to jail? Why not send them, as other programs have, a program that began here in Gloucester, Massachusetts, sending them to the hospital, sending them right into treatment, if that's your goal?
Well, in Ohio, the person who overdosed can refuse medical treatment. And he or she, after they receive their dose of Narcan and they're revived, can just basically refuse to go anywhere. Hmm. And then when that happens, the EMT squad that appears just leaves, and we have the addict still on the street. So by charging them, it gives us a way to control the number of overdoses that an individual has. Mm. We can put them in jail for a period of time, usually 3 to 5 days. We'll bring them down off of their out of their high on heroin. And at that point in time, we can talk to them about treatment. We don't charge them a lot of fines and cost and jail time. We just want to give them the opportunity to beat the addiction.
Yeah, the 180 days in jail and $1,000 fine are at the high end of the charge.
Yeah, that never happens.
Well, but you make the point, which is a serious one, that these people have the right not to get care, and so they go right back out. Talk a little bit about this recidivism.
Well, we had one young lady here about 2 weeks ago that overdosed one night. Her husband overdosed the same night, killed himself. We weren't able to revive him, and then the next night she overdoses and kills herself. So we need to be able to put these individuals in protective supervision in some manner to protect them, and I'm going to say from themselves, in order to allow them time to become mentally able to decide to be treated.
That is just an awful story. And, you know, we're hearing others from healthcare providers who say they see people, you know, several times a day. And it's so frustrating to feel that, well, what is your opinion on this? Because there is some opinion creeping in that maybe this miracle Narcan, which is, you know, an injection that can reverse an overdose, may actually be part of the problem if it's leading addicts to think that they don't have to get clean because they'll be revived.
Well, I don't think that's the case. Mm-hmm. I find that there comes a time that an addict becomes aware that heroin has taken such a toll on their lives that they want out, and I see quite a few every day.
Yeah. Do you think it'll have the effect, though, of having the loved ones around them not call? If they think that somebody who's gone into an overdose is going to be charged, you know, maybe they won't call, and then you will lose a life.
Well, I don't believe that's the case. I believe that ordinarily the drug addict will not be the one who's calling. It will be someone who is in the same room or in the same household or driving down the street, I don't think it's going to have any impact on the person who is overdosing.
Relatively new, but how many charges have there been?
There's about 8 to 10, I believe, so far.
Just in Washington Courthouse, Ohio.
Just in Washington Courthouse. We've had several overdoses in our little town. Since the beginning of the year, probably 40. Mm. So that's quite a few. Our resources are really stretched thin. Mm. Rehab is sometimes hard to get into. So we're having quite a chore here in reference to the overdoses.
Yeah. City Attorney Mark Pitstick in Washington Courthouse, Ohio. Mark, thank you so much and good luck with it.
Thank you. Take care.
Republicans in the House can only afford to lose 21 Republican votes if they want their health care bill to pass, and conservatives have been raising objections. One of them is Virginia Congressman Tom Garrett, who is a member of the House Freedom Caucus. He joins us on Skype. Congressman, welcome.
Jeremy, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And are you ready to vote for this bill, this American Health Care Act?
Not as it stands, but we're looking to find something we can vote for.
What is it that you would want changed?
Well, right now you've got essentially the rewarding of states who've exercised reckless policy as it related to Medicaid expansion to the detriment of states who've exercised fiscal restraint. You also have a massive entitlement program, the largest ever created on the watch of Republicans. And so those two items in and of themselves are showstoppers. There are some items in there that we're fond of. We like the expansion of access to HSAs.
Health savings lip service.
Correct. And there's some lip service towards being able to shop across state lines. I will say that there are a lot of bills that are not in this sort of omnibus package. So beyond just this package, there's a lot going on.
But if you were to make the kind of changes that you're talking about, wouldn't it lead to basically a lot less people being covered with health insurance in this country?
Not if we do this as comprehensively as we're trying to do it. Our office has a proposal that would take the individual mandate, shift it to a provider incentive, take the entire high-risk pre-existing condition pool, go to our hospitals, our healthcare providers, and say we have a national interest in insuring these folks. You guys provide care. To the extent that you provide care for them, we'll let you deduct that from your back-end federal taxes. So there are plans out there to address everything. What we want to do is do it in a free market manner without creating an entitlement.
When you say hospitals will provide care and you'll reimburse them later, does that mean people would just go to the emergency room as they used to?
No, not at all. Although I will tell you that the Affordable Care Act paradigm is a false paradigm. It's an Affordable Coverage Act, and it's not affordable. This just allows folks to say, hey, we're in the high-risk pool, and then essentially register with a provider, be it someone, whatever local source can provide the care they need, and then incense the provider to provide that coverage. It's, again, the closest thing to a free market solution you'll find. And it pulls the entire normal risk pool out immediately, then reducing premiums and deductibles. So there are a lot of moving parts here. It's tough to do your job. It really is. I mean that sincerely, because there's so many things to track. But I'm on the Education and Workforce Committee, and just the other day, we had three standalone health care bills that came out of committee that weren't part of the Ryan package. So again, the totality of this will not be done in one bill for a couple reasons, one of which is what we can get on the Senate side.
Well, do you think that your party is rushing this through?
You know, we've said that this is too important to rush through before. There's a little bit of irony in that it was Republicans who lamented the we must pass the bill to find out what's in it. And I don't want to repeat that failure. Secretly and behind closed doors, a lot of my colleagues on the other side of the aisle can point to lots of things they'd like to see changed in the Affordable Care Act, but it's not politically expedient to sort of help in seeking those out. So the deliberate process is a good thing, and so I think we will take some time on it. It doesn't need to be years, but it probably ought to be months. And I know that the American public is anxious, as are we. But let's get it right this time.
Do you think it is possible, Congressman, that people like you will oppose this bill and nothing will get passed and you'll end up with Obamacare?
Well, I suppose it's conceivable. I mean, If I were to write off any possibility on the front end, then that would eliminate any ability to negotiate on the back end. But what we know is the system is broken. It's in a death spiral. It's unsustainable. So we can't do nothing. But you don't start your negotiation by saying your final position. That's not the nature of the process.
Have you heard from President Trump yet? Has he tried to sway you on this?
Sure, but I'll tell you what. Here's what I believe as it relates to what we've heard from the president. He's not married to a plan. He's married to results. And I think he understands the nature of negotiation. I think he wants to ensure that the final product is better for the American people, provides more care at a more reasonable cost, that we bend the cost curve down. And I don't candidly think he's caught up in the minutia. So certainly there have been some tweets. I think there was one about this wonderful plan. Everything that we get is that he's wide open to negotiation and understands that's part of the process.
So he's not pressuring you right now?
Well, look, there's a lot of pressure to get a plan. I'm not going to succumb to it until we get a plan that I think fits within the fiscal constraints that we find ourselves facing and improves the system and improves access to care. I don't think those things are at any level mutually exclusive.
So the criticisms that you've been bringing up are very different from the criticisms that a lot of Democrats have of this bill. They want universal health care, many of them. What do you think about that? Is it possible to get universal health care in this country?
Well, I think we have it at some level because the indigent care system by law requires that people receive care. That's not how we want to do this. That's inherently inefficient and costly. We talked a lot about universal health care in 2009 and 2010. I think most Americans thought Obamacare was going to be universal health care. So what we're trying to do is create a circumstance where people go, hey, this is in my interest whether I end up needing health care in the immediate term or not. That's what a health savings account does. That's what good markets do. That's what isolating that high-risk pre-existing condition pool and creating an out-of-the-box solution for their care does. That's kind of the angle I'm coming from. You know, the funny thing is the argument early was Republicans have no plan. That was never true. We had lots of plans. We had no consensus. And so now we're working for a consensus.
That's Virginia Congressman Tom Garrett, a Republican and a member of the House Freedom Caucus. Congressman, thanks.
God bless you, Jeremy, and have a great day. Thanks for having us.
Well, in the first few weeks of the Trump administration, no Republican congressman has voted against the president more often than Walter Jones. Now, this shouldn't really come as a surprise. The longtime North Carolina representative has a well-established independent streak. And as Jeff Tiberi from Here and Now contributor WUNC reports, he shows no sign of breaking it.
In a district full of coiffed hair and pressed shirts, a frayed rug can stand out. On Capitol Hill, the office of Congressman Walter Jones is filled with home state relics, large framed pictures, crisp newspaper clippings, and shiny military medals, along with a faded North Carolina seal buckling under a coffee table.
The rug was worn out, but I brought the seal up here, and as you can tell, that the night crew doesn't care about keeping it straight, so I got to straighten it up when we finished the interview.
Jones purchased the rug 3 decades ago while serving in the North Carolina General Assembly as a Democrat. Today, yellow threads extend from the large fabric seal, a seal that, of course, bears the state motto, Esse quam videri, to be rather than to seem. It's a motto that could be applied to the state's ranking member of Congress, who has been in Washington for 12 terms as a Republican.
I am independent. I want to do what I think is right for the people of my district. And sometimes I cross party lines for that reason.
After losing a bid for the U.S. House in the 1990s, Walter Jones swapped the D for an R. His former chief of staff once said, when Jones votes, it's either as a conservative, a populist, or a libertarian. The son of a 12-term congressman, he's long been a staunch supporter of campaign finance reform and fiscal responsibility. Since January, Jones has voted in opposition of Trump's position nearly a quarter of the time. More recently, he became the first Republican to sign on to a bill calling for an outside investigation of Russia's possible involvement in the 2016 election.
It needs to be looked at by independent individuals, you know, Democrats or Republicans. They need not to be on that commission. We do not need to have foreign governments, whether it be a Republican or a Democrat, trying to influence policy and outcomes. So,
Walter Jones is Walter Jones. I think that's the best way to describe him. He's sort of an anomaly.
David McLennan teaches political science at Meredith College in Raleigh, North Carolina. He calls the congressman unconventional. Jones has great admiration for Roy Cooper, the state's Democratic governor, with whom he served in the General Assembly. He calls Newt Gingrich the most effective speaker he has worked with, Bill Clinton the best president. Last year, Jones voted against a relief package for victims of Hurricane Matthew, people living in his district because he said it had little to do with disaster relief.
That is sort of Walter Jones. I mean, he takes bold stands, whether it be against the Iraq War several years ago or now to eliminate the Department of Education right after Betsy DeVos was approved as the cabinet secretary.
To be fair, Jones says his plan to dissolve the Federal Department of Education, which was established during the Carter administration, began before the DeVos controversy. Jones adds that he probably would have voted against her if he were in the Senate. Jones represents the state's third U.S. House district. Terry Williams is a real estate agent in Greenville and one of his constituents.
I think probably the first thing everybody thinks about with Walter is his dedication to our vets, our veterans, and the things that he wants to see accomplished for that.
Jones's sprawling district stretches from Greenville to the northeast corner of the state, down the Outer Banks, includes Camp Lejeune, and extends to parts of Wilmington, 7,800 square miles in all. Williams is a loud and proud Trump supporter, and she wasn't exactly thrilled to hear about Jones's interest in an election investigation.
At this point, it's not bothering me. I don't think it's necessary. If he does it, I mean, I'm not going to not vote for him because he does it. I just think it's a waste of time and money.
When asked if one of his roles in the 115th Congress is to serve as a check on Trump, Jones deflects. The congressman turned 74 in February. He says he will focus on reining in spending, working with the Army Corps of Engineers on beach renourishment, and making the most of however long he keeps the D.C. office.
I tell people all the time I want to die in North Carolina, not in Washington, D.C. My health is good. I go home every weekend. I do the grocery shop, and I work in the office every weekend.
Jones will make a decision this summer on whether to seek re-election in 2018. For now, he's back and forth between Washington and Greenville, wearing out that seal as he goes. For Here and Now, I'm Jeff Tabiri.
Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson, and I want you to take a minute right now to think about the people you love. Have they ever listened to a podcast? Do they even know podcasts exist? All this month, we're asking our listeners to tell a friend about a podcast they love. You can do it in real life or on social media. And if they don't know how to download a podcast, give them a quick lesson. You'll be opening up a whole new world for them. Tell us what you're recommending with the hashtag tripod. That's hashtag TRYPOD. And thanks. The U.S. economy added 235,000 jobs last month, and the unemployment rate fell slightly to 4.7%. That's the news today from the Labor Department, and it was a strong showing for the first full month under President Trump. Ali Velshi is MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. He joins us now. Hi, Ali.
Hi, Jeremy.
So, good sign for the economy, today's jobs report?
Yeah, it is, because we had been gaining jobs at a rate of about 196,000 a month over the last year. And then last month, we saw a gain of 227,000, now 235. So it sort of indicates that we might have stepped up to a new level. If we sustain this for a few months, that'll be very positive, because what it means is we're taking up all that excess slack from the labor market that was caused by the recession, and that'll result in people seeing higher paychecks. Wages will start to go up.
Now, Trump and his supporters are heralding these numbers, but when strong jobs report came out under President Obama, Trump often derided them as weak. In December of 2012, he tweeted, "Today's jobs report is not a good sign, and we could be facing another recession. No real job growth. We need over 300,000 new jobs a month." And he also often called government unemployment numbers fake. Early last year, he told supporters, "Don't believe these phony numbers. The number is probably 28, 29, as high as 35%. In fact, I even recently heard 42%. So,
yeah. And I haven't really seen a stat as quickly debunked as that one. I mean, most of us in the business world follow this stuff very, very closely. It's the one big economic number a month that really helps us track the economy. I'll give you a little context. First of all, every February for the last 4 years has seen at least 235,000 jobs created or more. This is actually on par with the lowest for the last 4 years. Mm. Number two, the unemployment number, 4.7%, is conducted by a survey method that a lot of people think is a little out of date. But economists generally feel that it's reflective of the trend. So if it's not exactly 4.7%, the fact that it's been trending lower and lower since the recession is something that matches up. Now, there are a lot of people who are underemployed, meaning They're not doing the job they're trained for, the job they'd like, they don't get the salary they want, or they're not getting benefits. When you add that all up, you come out to a government number in the 9% range, and that's generally accepted as the unemployed and the underemployed. We're not in double digits. We're certainly not in 28, 38, 42%. None of that. That's just – it's a pants on fire for Pinocchio lie.
Okay. So the other thing that I want to talk to you about, Ali, is that this week marks 8 years exactly since the S&P 500 hit its low point, 666 points. It's quite amazing how much the stock market has gone
up. Yeah, and it's the lesson to people who have investments that regular people can't time the market. You never know when the bottom's going to hit, and you don't know when the top is going to hit. So a steady investment strategy helps. If you had put $1,000 in the market on March 9th of 2009, it would be worth $3,400 today. But I remember those days interviewing people and trying to figure out where the bottom of the market was.
Yeah.
It's very hard. The bottom is a very rocky thing, I like to say. You never actually know until you're in the rearview mirror, and you generally have to be a few months away from it to recognize that was the bottom.
And we now know that the people that sold right at the bottom made a really bad move.
Yeah.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
The idea for this music... began as a strange dream more than a century ago. It's Petrushka. Russian composer Igor Stravinsky wrote it in 1911 for the famous Ballet Russe company when he was 29 years old, making a name for himself with his groundbreaking music. It tells the story of three puppets who come to life at a holiday fair. Petrushka, a Punch and Judy-type figure in Russian folklore, the ballerina who rejects him, and the Moor who kills him. Yikes! This music traumatized our next guest when she was a young musician in college. But as we're learning in our occasional conversations with her, there's a lot about classical music that traumatizes Fran Hoffner. She writes the often colorful Classical Music with Fran column for The All and joins us again. Hi, Fran.
Hi, Robin. How you doing?
I'm good. And this time I don't blame you. Evil puppets. And how shocking was this at its premiere in 1911?
I mean, incredibly shocking. I think these are audiences who are used to ballets that sound like the Nutcracker, and this sounds nothing like the Nutcracker.
Right. You can hear the strangeness in the music. There's this. Well, Stravinsky also had Firebird Suite and then Rite of Spring, which caused riots. So where does Petrushka fall?
Petrushka falls right in the middle of both of those. Stravinsky had a lot of early success with Firebird. I think we mentioned at this point he's only 29. Mm-hmm. So for Firebird to come so early in his career, he's already very popular. And then this is sort of him. I mean, Firebird is a strange piece of music, but I think it sounds generally more traditional than Petrushka. And then to have this sort of very conceptual, weird ballet, and then go into Rite of Spring, which, as you said, caused riots. I think it was Camille Saint-Saëns who was at the premiere of Rite of Spring and walked out because he was so put off by what it sounded like.
It's just so odd now because it sounds almost traditional now as we listen even to Petrushka. But take us back because it's interesting. I sometimes think, Fran, that we should bring a therapist into our conversations because this music, you know, that you were learning when you were, you know, playing in college, for instance, you know, this was unsettling for you. You said it's one of the most typical pieces you played as a percussionist.
Definitely. Well, I think also just as a college percussionist, we played a lot of French classical music or a lot of Beethoven, which feels more, even more traditional than Petrushka does now. Yeah. And that's got very sort of easy rhythmic percussion parts that land on downbeats or even in the weirder pieces on the offbeats, but very sort of easy to puzzle your way through. And Petrushka had more percussion parts than I had ever seen in sort of a traditional classical piece of music. you know, you've got your xylophone and your crash cymbals and your triangle and your tambourine and your timpani and bass drum and snare. And there were only so many of us percussionists in Southwest Michigan. And these were tough parts. These weren't necessarily things that you could just learn on the fly.
Well, we've been listening to a part called The Russian Dance. Let's bring that up a little. So there's a little glissando there, a little...
Yeah, there's that little glissando that you have to nail.
And remind people, glissando, it's like stretching out a moment, but tell us more about it.
Yeah, so you're if you're a xylophonist, you're going to hit the first note of the glissando and then simply drag the mallet along the instrument. You're trying to hit every key on your way up to the top note. Glissandos can be anywhere from covering five notes to the entire span of the xylophone. And the idea is you've got to time it so that you get that first and last note right on the beat and knowing how quickly to move your arm so that there's, you know, an equal amount of weight given to each note as you go up. There is like a weird science to it that you've got to nail. And there's two glissandos right at the start of that Russian dance. Both come in on off beats and they're tough. You, as a percussionist playing Petrushka, I really had to go by musical cues from other instruments rather than just counting in my own head and watching the conductor.
And you say you still have almost like flashbacks.
Yeah. I mean, this was a really stressful piece to put together. I went to a school that was on trimesters. So we had 8 weeks to get Petrushka together with one rehearsal a week. I mean, I didn't go to a music college, but this was a tough piece to put in front of musicians and for us to essentially learn with like an hour a week for only so long.
Yeah.
And, you know, there were other pieces. I think we were doing this like very mild Debussy suite in the same concert series. And that, you know, after a rehearsal and a half, I was like, this is down. And Petrushka, I just had to listen to all quarter to get to understand it.
Well, it's not just the rhythm section. He used polytonality or bitonality, instruments playing in more than one key at once. Let's listen. Again, now it feels almost, you know, melodic.
Yeah, and even, I mean, I remember that first rehearsal thinking it sounded so wrong. I was like, someone has to have come in early. This doesn't sound right. We didn't get recordings or anything ahead of time. We found out that first rehearsal based on what was on our music stands while we were playing. So this became sort of this deep study I had to do of this piece of music to make it sound correct to me, which I think is also what was happening at the time it came out.
Yeah. Well, one of your favorite moments, we understand, a waltz after the dance of the ballerina, there's a bassoon solo. Let's listen. I love that. What do you like about that?
It's just very sweet. And the nice thing you get in a ballet, if you're not seeing it, which obviously we didn't put up the entire ballet, we just played Petrushka, is that you get instruments becoming the characters.
Yeah. The duet with the ballerina is between a snare drum and a trumpet. The ballerina is the trumpet. Let's listen. I mean, that's just fun.
Yeah. And I think it's also rare to have a trumpet portray a feminine character. The trumpet's usually a very masculine, and this is almost a little bit of a like military sound to it. But I think it's just meant to express that this is not sort of a frail damsel in distress. This is a pretty decisive, powerful ballerina.
Hmm. Well, but poor Petrushka, as we mentioned, he gets offed by the Moor. But in the end, his ghost is hovering overhead. Is that what we're hearing?
Yeah. It ends on a pretty sour note.
So this is right before the Russian Revolution, right before World War I. What is Stravinsky saying?
I mean, this is sort of, to harken back to folk tales, this is this sort of weird, I mean, Russia's always been caught up in this weird binary between the past and the future, and this is taking one of the most traditional forms of storytelling and folk tales and setting it to this extremely weird postmodern music. I mean, the Russians were sort of the most groundbreaking in terms of classical music at this time. And I think that's really evident that there's sort of this urgency to modernize, mm-hmm. at least in the arts. But it just always feels new and fresh. And it sort of has transformed into this piece that I love to listen to now because I get something new out of it every single time, now that I'm not constantly sort of waiting for percussion cues.
And sweating.
Yeah.
That's Fran Hoffner. She writes the Classical Music with Fran column for The All. Our occasional visit with her to deconstruct a piece that's meant a lot to her, or, you know, we'll send her to the therapist's couch. Fran, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Robin.
And you're listening to Here and Now.
And nearly a week has gone by since President Trump claimed he was wiretapped by President Obama, and we have yet to see any evidence to back that up. The White House has said it's up to Congress to look into the president's allegations. But what does a claim like that, without evidence, do to the president's credibility? Joining us now is Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Julian, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And let's go back to some of the other examples. There were claims, of course, that President Trump made about President Obama's birthplace even after Obama released his birth certificate in 2012. Here he is.
A lot of people do not think it was an authentic certificate.
How can you say that if the...
You won't report it, Wolf, but many people do not think it was authentic.
And then during the campaign last year, Trump implied that his rival Ted Cruz's father was somehow connected to the JFK assassination.
You know, his father was with Lee Harvey Oswald prior to Oswald's being, shot. I mean, the whole thing is ridiculous. What is this right prior to his being shot? And nobody even brings it up. I mean, they don't even talk about that. That was reported, and nobody talks about it. But I think it's horrible. I think it's absolutely horrible.
And then more recently, he said that he lost the popular vote to Hillary Clinton because millions of people voted illegally. And 5 days after his inauguration, he was asked about the voter fraud claim by ABC's David Muir.
We're going to launch an investigation to find out. And then the next time, and I will say this, of those votes cast, none of them come to me. None of them come to me. They would all be for the other side.
Again, no proof of that. Julian, what's the danger of this?
Well, it's clear that President Trump has a credibility problem. For what we see in national polls, a lot of people don't trust him and don't believe him. And we know many overseas leaders are uneasy when he says things. So this is still early in the presidency, but I think the ongoing flurry of falsehoods and lies really has undermined his ability to persuade people that he's telling the truth. The good news is many Republicans still believe him. So the partisan poll is the one place where all of this doesn't seem to have a huge effect yet.
And is it more, though, about American people trusting him or about foreign leaders trusting him? I'm just thinking if there was some sort of emergency and the president's word is really important here and around the world, what happens if people don't believe what he says?
I think they're both important. If a crisis happened, whether it was a foreign policy or economic crisis, ultimately, he needs political support here in the U.S. beyond his base. And it will be very difficult for him to convince people that he's telling them things that are true. And I think overseas, it's the same problem. Many leaders won't trust him if he asks for assistance or he says something needs to be done. So the consequences of this can be quite serious in those kinds of situations.
Well, let's go back to some previous examples. This is Bill Clinton, famously, on January 26th, 1998.
I want you to listen to me. I'm going to say this again. I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky. I never told anybody to lie, not a single time, never. These allegations are false.
I feel like I've heard that so many times I could probably recite it without even looking at it. But, of course, we know that was not true. Clinton had a sexual relationship with Monica Lewinsky. He was impeached but acquitted. But did he lose credibility?
Well, I think that's a case where it was a question of credibility of something that wasn't that important in many people's minds or wasn't significant enough to be a high-profile political issue. So he was able to continue with his presidency. He even conducts bombing against Iraq while this is going right. on. And the public ultimately likes him more rather than less. Part of what was going on is the credibility of his opponents was equally low, meaning Newt Gingrich, the Speaker of the House, and other Republicans. So I think that buffered some of the damage that that lie might have had.
And then what about President Nixon on November 17th, 1973? Here he is.
People have got to know whether or not their president is a crook. Well, I'm not a crook.
Nixon speaking during a televised news conference in which he denied involvement in the Watergate cover-up, which, of course, was not true. Nixon resigned less than a year later. What about that? Did he? I mean, he left office, so I guess he lost his credibility.
Yeah, that's a case where credibility about a big issue, a scandal, an investigation really mattered. The political support that he had to stay in office vanished by the end of his presidency, including among Republicans. And this was part of why he had to resign. He knew that an impeachment might very well happen, in part because no one believed or trusted him. Ironically, his predecessor suffered this as well, Lyndon Johnson, as a result of Vietnam, where by the end of his term, he had very little political support because no one believed what he was saying about the war.
So at this point, would it be better for Trump to come out and say, okay, never mind, I was wrong. I didn't mean what I said about President Obama wiretapping me, or to just stick with this, what he's saying?
Well, I don't think his calculation is the same as the one that we're talking about. I think he believes he can destabilize institutions and create alternative narratives, essentially, about what's happening, and that his supporters like that. His goal is to shore up support among Republicans and among red America. If he can do that, he believes he can be a successful president, so this won't matter.
Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton. Thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.